Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Good afternoon to you. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. 50 years ago last month, Catherine Kitty Genovese was brutally raped and stabbed to death very close to her apartment building on Austin Street in the serene neighborhood of Kew Gardens in Queens, New York. There was very little coverage of the crime until the New York Times picked up the story 2 weeks later. It was reported that as many as 38 witnesses had seen the crime and did nothing to help. The case became scandalous and sparked a sociological theory, the bystander effect, now a mainstay of psychology textbooks. Today we visit with journalist and award-winning author Kevin Cook. He argues that the real story of Kitty Genovese is far more complicated. His latest book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. And Kevin Cook joins us from NPR in New York. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thanks. I'm glad to be with you.
Great to have you. I thought we'd begin, Kevin, with a look back to March of 1964. It was just a few months after the assassination of President Kennedy. What was happening in New York City and the country, politically, sociologically, racially? What was going on?
It was a remarkable time. As you say, the Kennedy assassination had occurred just the previous November. The World's Fair was coming to town with the famous Unisphere going up near the crime scene in Kew Gardens. The Beatles had just landed at newly renamed JFK Airport and were going right through Queens on their way to the Ed Sullivan Show. There was a great deal of racial tension. The Cold War was at its height. Truly a remarkable time in New York City that is the backdrop to the notorious crime of the spring of 64 when Kitty Genovese was killed.
And you do a lot of descriptions of what was going on in New York in the book. It's really thorough, and I appreciated that because you really set the scene.
It's an amazing time, truly, and not only in Kew Gardens, but she and her partner, Marianne Zelenko, used to go into the city where, if you're in Greenwich Village, the beatniks are reciting poetry on the corner while the folkies are playing. Bob Dylan has just changed his name from Robert Zimmerman, and he's playing at Folk City. And there's a thriving gay subculture as well in Greenwich Village.
Well, I guess I'll hold back right now. Well, let's talk about Kitty Genovese then. We'll do that now. She was in many ways a really independent woman, an unusual woman for those times. So tell us about her.
She was. She was making her own way in the world. She came from Brooklyn, from a strict Catholic family in Brooklyn, and stayed in the city after her mother witnessed a murder in Brooklyn. The family went to the suburbs, and Kitty Genovese, who saw herself as a city girl, said, I want to stay. This is where I'm happy. She worked as a secretary at first. Later, she worked as a bartender and manager. She was, by all accounts, generous, charming. She worked very hard. She liked to drive fast in a little red Fiat that she loved. She worked double shifts. The one reason that she was out in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. On the last night of her life was that she had put in two shifts at the bar where she worked about 10 minutes away.
But it wasn't for naught. She had dreams of opening her own restaurant one day and wanted to learn the business, right?
She did, and she was very popular with her customers. She talked about the Italian restaurant that she hoped to run one day. She had her whole life ahead of her. In fact, it's remarkable to think that while her killer is still alive, she's been gone for 50 years and would have had a chance to turn 79 years old this year.
So, describe for us the neighborhood of Kew Gardens where she moved. What was it like? I mentioned it was serene, but tell us more.
It was. It was leafy. It was a hamlet only about 20 minutes by train from New York City. It's often imagined, I think, in the popular memory as a very gritty sort of urban scene, as though it were in Hell's Kitchen with tenements and fire escapes, a scene from West Side Story. And in fact, it was a nearly crime-free area, low rises. The tallest building in the neighborhood was the nine-story Mowbray apartment building across the street from the crime scene. The building where Kitty and Mary Ann had a little apartment was only two stories tall, a faux Tudor apartment building. People greeted their neighbors. Girl Scouts sold cookies after dark, door to door, and people didn't lock their doors after dark.
Including their cars, mostly.
That's true. Kitty Genovese was very fond and wanted to make sure that her car was fine at all times. She took an extra moment to lock her car, which was unusual in that neighborhood in that time, although it was 3 a.m. when she was doing that. And that sort of delay left her prey to the random act that the killer who came after her.
Okay, so let us go back to those early morning hours, 3 in the morning, March 13th, 1964. According to popular accounts, what happened?
Popular accounts have it, according to the Times that you referred to earlier, 2 weeks later, the front page of the Times has this story that Kitty Genovese was getting out of her car when she was attacked at random out by a monster springing from the darkness with a knife. This much is true. She was then attacked over the course of 30 minutes while 38 witnesses looked out their windows and did not lift a finger to call the police or to help her. Those 38 witnesses looking out their windows watched three separate attacks on her. No one called the police, and no one made any effort to help Kitty, and that's why the story became really symbolic of urban apathy and the deterioration, I think, of life in the big city, the big, cold, heartless city. As it turns out, very little of that story is true.
Now, the background to how this story got printed is interesting. Martin Gansberg actually wrote the story, but tell how this happened with Abe Rosenthal, who he was, and how it came to be that 38 people watched this crime over the course of 35 minutes and no one did anything.
Abraham Rosenthal was the new metropolitan editor of the New York Times. Had great ambitions to change the way that the newspaper told its readers about modern life, to tell big stories, and he certainly wanted to tell them factually. But perhaps first, at least in this case, he wanted to have an impact on his readers. It was almost 2 weeks after the crime, 10 days after Kitty Genovese had been killed, and the story had been reported, including in the Times, for a short four-paragraph item. It was again and again reported in various papers as one of the 600-plus murders that happened in the city that year. Queens woman stabbed. But 10 days after the crime, Editor Rosenthal had lunch with the commissioner of police. Michael Bull Murphy was his name. And he changed the subject from a topic that Rosenthal had asked about, that the police department didn't really want to discuss. And what he said at the end of their lunch was, you know, the story that you ought to look at is that one out there in Queens. There were 38 witnesses. 38 witnesses didn't do anything to help that poor girl. Abraham Rosenthal said 38, and Murphy repeated 38. This is how the story then begins to take shape in Rosenthal's mind. He knows that readers will respond to this. The number is helpful in its specificity. He sends the reporter Martin Gansberg out to follow up on the police report, and the police account of what happened that night does appear 2 weeks after the crime, splashed all the way across the lower half of the front page of the New York Times. 38 witnesses did not do anything to help Kitty Genovese, and that is the moment at which this story takes on national significance and even international significance and becomes not about the murder victim or about the killer, but about the witnesses.
So what's actually happening is this brutal murder is no longer the fault of this psychopath and this maniac. It's the fault of the bystanders who did nothing to help.
That was the thrust of the story. How could these people watch out their windows for 30 minutes and allow this young woman to die? Surely this explained something awful about modern America, the malaise that that infected us, that the urban life was turning us somehow into the sort of neighbors who not only didn't know our names, the names of our own neighbors, but wouldn't lift a finger to help them. I think that's why the story had such resonance. It was reported internationally. It was a case in which a police lieutenant came out after the crime and gestured toward a Life magazine reporter toward the leafy, peaceful-seeming streets and said, "It doesn't look like a jungle, does it?" The thrust was that this had been a jungle in which the neighbors left Kitty Genovese to die. In fact, it was far more complicated than that, as my research did eventually show.
We need to take a break, but before we do, I'd just like to ask you, nearly a half century later, what brought you, and 4 decades after the only other book on the subject, what brought you, who had, I don't think you've ever written about something like this, to investigate this case? Did it just not add up to you? Why did you go back over this?
There's an aspect of that. This was my first crime book. I have written about recent American history before, and I'm fascinated by the ways that something 50 years ago can seem both so recent and so distant. It was a different world. I realized that the 50th anniversary of this crime was coming up, and that the way that it had been told for half a century seemed almost too simple. It seemed to teach us such a story that that the life and death of this young woman had come to be a tool to teach us something, teach all the rest of us a lesson. And that sounded a little too pat, as it turned out. I believe it certainly was.
We're speaking with Kevin Cook. He's an award-winning author. His latest book and journalist, his latest book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. We're going to take a short break. Before we do, Kevin, do you have a website?
There is a Tumblr site, kittygenovesebook.tumblr.com, and the book's also told about extensively at Amazon, and of course I always want to encourage people to visit their local independent bookstores too.
Of course. All right, let's take that break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Kevin Cook. He is an award-winning author and journalist. He's written for the New York Times, Vogue, The Daily News, GQ, among other publications, and his latest book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. Kevin, it occurred to me as I was reading this book that you were really like a detective in order to actually come up with all this stuff. So just tell us a little about your research and how you, what process you used to investigate this.
It turns out there is a great deal of research that hasn't been looked at in many, many years. I wound up with not only a lot of press reports, and the press reports were crucial and fascinating the way that they changed from the course of those 2 weeks from before the crime, when the crime was almost a police blotter item, to 2 weeks later, when suddenly it becomes an international cause célèbre that's supposed to explain something about modern life. From there, the detective story takes one in any number of different directions, and you need friends. And I wound up having some allies who were extremely valuable to me, none more than Marianne Zelenko, who was Kitty's partner, her life partner. People did not realize at the time, it was not reported at the time, that that Kitty was a lesbian, that that she and Marianne had been together for precisely 1 year on the night that Kitty died. That's one reason the police saw Marianne, her partner, as the prime suspect initially, because gay people were thought to be more prone to crimes of passion, and she was grilled for 6 hours. Marianne is a very, very private person and didn't speak about the crime for almost 40 years before she spent a minute with NPR 10 years ago, and then spent a great deal more time than that with me at some emotional cost to her. But she felt that it was important to talk about a young woman that that she still mourns 50 years later.
Well, we have that. We have that sound clip when she did speak to Scott Simon 10 years ago. If you don't mind, because it was her first and only interview until she spoke with you, and it was very brief. Do you mind if we play it now?
Well, I'd like to hear it again.
Today we have the first and only broadcast interview Marianne Zelenko has ever granted, which comes to us from Sound Portrait Productions in New York.
Kitty was the most wonderful person I've ever met. I still remember her face. I can see it in my mind. Very Italian looking, very chiseled features, dark hair, only about 5 feet tall, a very likable person, very vibrant, where I'm very quiet. So we were complimentary. I think we met in a bar downtown, and she says, well, you know, I'd like to see you again. So I said, well, I don't have a phone. I lived in a rooming house. I came home that night from work, and I found a note on the rooming house door. She found where I lived and called me at the payphone that night. So we're together for a year after that. 1 year. 1 year exactly. To the day. Being a gay woman in that society was very hard. So we were in the closet a lot. In fact, her family didn't know. I mean, they know now. But there was denial there. It was very hard then. I remember I went bowling with a friend of ours, and I came home. I was tired that night. It was probably, I got home about 11:30. I went to bed, and the next thing I remember is the police knocking on the door at 4 o'clock in the morning. So they took me to the emergency room. They said, you have to identify. So I did. Standard identifying a person with a white sheet. And I went outside and sat on the bench, and they said, we're going to take him. I said, I'm going to wait for her. Sorry, I'm going to start crying here, but this gets rough. So I just went home and I started drinking, so I couldn't deal with this. And I drank for about 6 months, and I realized, this is, what am I doing with my life? So I stopped drinking, I got an apartment, and I went back to school. So, I mean, I know about loss. I saw a lot of anger toward people because they could have saved her life. I mean, all the steps along the way when he attacked her 3 times, and then he sexually assaulted her too when she was dying. I mean, you look out the window and you see this happening and you don't help. It's, how do you live with yourself knowing you didn't do anything? That's the biggest lesson to be learned from this. Really love each other. We have to on this planet.
Kitty Genovese was murdered 40 years ago today. Marianne Zolanko lives in Vermont. Winston Mosley, who was convicted of the murder, is serving a life sentence. Our story was produced by Matt Ozug and Jessica Tickton at Sound Portrait Productions. For more information, you can come to our website, npr.org.
And that was a Sound Portrait, and you were listening to Marianne Zolanko, but I'll let you, Kevin Cook, I'd like to know how she feels about what you've uncovered. Were you able to get that information from her?
Yes, she's appreciative. She is glad that that there is a book that's not only about Kitty's death, but about her life. And that was a goal of mine, that this is a young woman who was known by her picture, by her name, and hardly anything else. She's known for the last half hour of her life and not the rest of it. She was someone that Marianne loved. She was extremely likable, as far as I can tell, and I feel that I hope that she would be pleased that her life story has been told. Marianne did send me a sweet note saying how much she appreciated the fact that her story and Kitty's had been told. She is an extremely private person, so I'm extremely grateful to her for taking the time that she did to talk with me.
What do you think moved her to assist you? I mean, she did this one interview in 50 years. Why do you think she finally, I know it took a lot on your part to get her cooperation, but what do you think finally moved her to do so?
I think she remembered that there had been some positive reaction to, at least nothing awful happened after she spoke with NPR for that Sound Portrait, and I think that she felt enough time had passed that maybe it didn't hurt quite as acutely as it had before, and she also wants Kitty Genovese to be remembered.
I'd like to move on to the murderer now. You have quite a bit about him. You painted a great detailed portrait of him in your book. Let's talk about Winston Mosley, his childhood, his fascination with animals, insects, and his adulthood. Would you?
Yes, he is a chilling figure. It's possible to feel some sympathy for his very difficult childhood. His mother abandoned him. He found out that the man he considered his father wasn't his biological father. A little later on, he was nonetheless an upstanding, steady he was a husband, a family man, as the police were surprised to find. Held a steady job at an early computer business machine company called Ray Graham. His wife worked nights. He was married. They had one child of their own and had taken in another. He, by all accounts, appeared to be the American dream at work. Young black family that owned their own home not far from JFK Airport. But his wife did detect deterioration in Winston Mosley. He began burglarizing homes, partly to take appliances to his father, who had a TV repair shop. But that progressed from there to rape and finally to murder. Kitty was not the first person that he murdered. He was out looking for random victims and set out to find one. One of the tragedies of that night is that he had enough possession of his faculties that he was willing to give up. He drove around looking for a victim. He was small. He 5'3", weighed 125 pounds, somewhat cowardly in many situations, and was looking for someone small enough to overpower, as she was. He happened to see her leaving her work and getting into her little red Fiat, and followed her back to the crime scene where he attacked her.
And he was also, I'd like you to talk about his, he had exceptional intelligence and that incredible mild manner, which was a little disarming.
A very chilly, almost robotic sound. I did manage to track down an audio tape of his voice, and it's nearly affectless, talking about some of the ugliest actions that one could imagine. He had an IQ measured in the 130s. There was a remarkable moment in which one of the attorneys who represented him told me about a time they were speaking in a prison library and a cockroach ran across the floor. The lawyer went to step on it, and it managed to skitter away. The lawyer says, "Oh, well, they know when you're going to try to step on them." And Winston Mosley, who knew insects, who knew animals, and really specialized in the knowledge of insects, said, "No, that's not correct. They have cilia. They have small hairs on their bodies that can detect air currents moving." And the lawyer went and looked it up, and he was exactly right. He was a character who then became somewhat of a prison lawyer. Filed many attempts to get out on parole. In fact, he escaped once in 1968, escaped from Attica, and went on a brief crime rampage in Buffalo.
And during that rampage, didn't he rape some
women? Two more women, yes, and later claimed that it proved he was really contributing to society because he'd chosen not to kill them. This is a man who rationalizes his actions to the degree that he wrote an op-ed story in the New York Times claiming that he'd performed a service by letting us all know that it's important to come to the aid of our other citizens when we see that they're in jeopardy.
We're speaking with Kevin Cook, and his latest book is, Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and take some calls and your emails. Stay with us. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, visiting with Kevin Cook, an award-winning author and journalist. His latest book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystander, The Crime That Changed America. If you have a question for Kevin or a comment, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio at WLRN.org, radio at WLRN.org. I'd like to just go back for a moment to Winston Mosley. It was a very ironic twist of fate that actually led to his arrest for this crime. He might not have even been caught. Tell us what happened.
That is one of the oddities of the story. He was staging another burglary. He was out in the not far from his home in Ozone Park, Queens, and was putting a television into the back seat of his car, the same car he had that he had followed Kitty in several days before. He was putting the television in there when a concerned citizen stopped him and said, what are you doing there? Isn't that my neighbor's TV? He said, well, I'm helping them move, Mosley said. It's all right, I'm helping them move. At that point, the neighbor called another neighbor and said, have you heard that the Bannisters are moving? Well, no, we haven't. They contacted the police, who came out, and while they were waiting for the police, they disabled the car. They were better at, automotive mechanics than I would have been.
Right.
They lifted the hood and pulled some wires, disabled the car, and Mosley was unable to get the car started. He was blithely walking away when a squad car pulled up. They questioned him about burglary, and it wasn't long before he began confessing to murder.
It's also, talk about his sentence. He was actually sentenced, the prosecution got what they wanted, but then he was able to avoid his execution. Tell us about that.
That's true. The judge was an avowed opponent of the death penalty, and I have attorneys on both sides told me that they believe what he had put into the case was what's called a poison pill, something that would be reversed on appeal when suddenly there isn't an international outcry calling for the execution of this vicious killer, Winston Mosley. So the judge named Irwin Shapiro actually announced when the sentence was pronounced, a sentence of death in the electric chair. He said, I don't usually say such a thing, but I would be willing to throw the switch on the electric chair myself. That's what a heinous crime this has been. But later, indeed, the appeal succeeded, and the sentence was reduced to life in prison. And those who are in favor of the death penalty could certainly point to a case like this. Mosley then is around 4 years later to escape in a remarkable part of this remarkable tale, to escape and hole up in Buffalo for 3 days, rape two more women before it takes 200-some FBI agents and police officers to surround him and finally recapture him.
Yeah, it was an amazing story. I mean, he actually made it so he had to go to a hospital, we'll just say that.
That's true, and in ways that one doesn't want to contemplate,
no.
managed to get himself sent to a different hospital and escaped along the way.
Now, he's gone to some lengths to obtain his freedom. Do you think he will ever be granted parole?
I do not. I am on good terms with the people in the Queens District Attorney's Office. One of their jobs is to convince the parole board that this is not someone that the rest of us should be exposed to. In fact, the Assistant District Attorney, Testa Grossa, also handles similar duties in the case of the son of Sam, David Berkowitz, and told me that he feels that Winston Mosley is a much more dangerous predator than the son of Sam was.
Mm. We have a caller. It looks like Lydia was 10 years old in Kew Gardens. Hmm. Lydia,
yes,
welcome to Topical Currents.
What a blast from the past. It's a great program. Thank you very much. Having grown up in Kew Gardens, I went to the public school that was right up the hill from that building that you're talking about on Austin Street. I have to tell you, after the murder, it changed, and I remember this even at 10. It changed the tenor of the community. It was very carefree. I mean, kids would go all up. Well, it was also in the 60s, so kids were out and about until it got dark. But after that, it really changed the way the parents and the children were allowed to do certain things in the community. It was a very scary time. And I'm so glad that you wrote the other side of the story, and I will be buying your book.
did some of the neighbors move away?
I didn't live in that building, so no, none of my friends moved out of the neighborhood. It was a great little town. It really was. It was, like you said, 20 minutes from Manhattan, and it felt like it was so far away. It was a really good community, And when this happened, then I believe there was a movie about it also, wasn't there?
There was a television movie.
That's what it was, right. It just, it, you know, haunted the neighborhood for a long time. And I remember as a freshman in college, that was in my psychology book.
Right. And we'll talk about that. Lydia, I'm just wondering if your parents changed the way, I mean, did they stop you from going outside and playing? What?
No, they did not. We did not live anywhere close to that area, but I remember for probably a few weeks, my mother would walk me to school, and at 10 years old, that was really embarrassing.
Mm.
Because that, there's a street. It happened on Austin Street, and the next drag was Lefferts Boulevard. The block before Lefferts Boulevard, we would go up the hill to the public school, but the parents started walking the children. It was very unnerving. Mm.
Okay. So, well, thank you so much for calling, Lydia.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good show. Bye-bye.
Thank you. The number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio at WLRN.org. I guess, Kevin, I'd like to talk about the witnesses now, the eyewitnesses, the ear witnesses. Mm-hmm. Where did the number 38 actually come from?
It took some detection to find that number. I should say briefly what I believe to have happened that night, absolutely opposite of the story of 38 people looking out their windows. There were two attacks on Kitty Genovese. The first, Winston Mosley sprang out of the darkness and stabbed her. She was on the sidewalk, and she screamed loudly enough to wake a number of people, as you call them, both eyewitnesses and ear witnesses. Many people in that neighborhood were accustomed to hearing people yelling at the top of their lungs in the middle of the night. There was a bar that was open until 4 a.m. There were fights spilling out of there. There were domestic arguments and when Kitty Genovese screamed, more than 38 people heard her screams. There's little doubt of that. By the time people wake up, though, and they get to their windows, realize that this is panic. This is not something that one hears very often at 3 a.m. The murderer has fled, and the reason he fled is because one of her neighbors lifted his window and screamed, "Leave that girl alone." Robert Moser, exactly. He thought that he was seeing a domestic fight. He yells, "Leave that girl alone." Winston Mosley runs to his car, and he actually backed it up into the darkness so that the car wouldn't be conspicuous. He waited to see what would happen. And at that point, Kitty Genovese, who is not fatally injured, she's been stabbed to the point that one of her lungs has been punctured. She can't scream as loudly as she did before, but she bravely stood and walked. She tried to get home. She tried to get to the entrance of her apartment where Marianne was sleeping upstairs. That was in back of the same building. She walked around a corner under a drugstore sign and disappeared from view of all those windows on Austin Street. Those witnesses who were supposedly watching her throughout this period lost sight of her. And before long, there is nothing to see on the street. They began to go back to bed. And Winston Mosley, waiting to see whether the coast was clear, decided that he would continue with what he said, finishing the job he set out to do. He followed Kitty. He tried the railroad station depot door, and it was locked. He tried the coffee shop door, and it was locked. He found Kitty collapsed at the foot of the stairs, not the stairs that led to her own apartment, but those that led to a friend, a neighbor's apartment. She was alone. One thing that we do know is how many witnesses there were to the second attack that came after that, when Mosley set about stabbing her in the second and fatal attack. There was one witness, and that was the man who opened the door briefly at the top of the stairs.
Carl Ross.
That's his name.
Were you able to talk to Carl Ross or interview him for this book?
I was not. He made himself scarce very shortly after the crime and has not been heard from since.
Now, isn't he the one that, when questioned by the police, said, "I didn't want to get involved," which became this phrase that stood
right
for this apathy of Americans?
and it was quoted worldwide. I didn't want to get involved. And he did say that, explaining why he hadn't even called the police. I don't think one should expect someone to go and try to stop a knife-wielding maniac. What he should have done was to call the police. And he is one. There was another man named Joseph Fink, who was the superintendent of the building across the street, who did witness the first attack on Kitty and did not do anything about it. He told the police later he thought about going to get a baseball bat and doing something. Instead, he went downstairs and took a nap. It's certainly not the case that no one knew what was going on and could have helped Kitty. There were some, many people who were confused, didn't know what was going on. There were some who could have helped her and did not. And to go back to that number 38, it's been a mystery ever since. I finally tracked down an account that is a collection of the interviews that the detectives did, and they handed up to the district attorney's office, to the prosecutors, after they had done their initial round of interviews with the neighbors. And I counted the number of neighbors, and there were 40 plus. There were 49. And I wondered why, where are we going to come up with a number that makes sense out of this? Many of those witnesses lived in an apartment with two or three, maybe other people, and the detectives would consider that one entry. And if you count up the entries on this document, this police department document that was dated 2 weeks after the crime, there are 38 entries. I believe there was some harried civil servant who wanted to give the police commissioner what he was asking for, gave him the number of entries, and that's how the number 38 entered the American memory.
We're speaking with Kevin Cook, and his latest book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, the Bystanders, the Crime That Changed America. One more short break, and we'll be right back. Thank you for joining us for Topical Currents on this Monday afternoon. Bonnie Berman with Kevin Cook, an award-winning author, and the author of Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. Again, the number, if you'd like to join in the conversation, is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Kevin, what about Carl Ross? I'd like you to talk more about what it was like back in 1964 if somebody did want to report a crime. There was no 911 yet. And more about perhaps why he didn't call the police.
It is crucial to note that there was no 911. The 911 emergency telephone system rose more or less directly from the outcry after Kitty Genovese's death. In those days, you called a number that was on your telephone book. You got a dispatcher at the nearby precinct or a central one. You might get a desk sergeant who would invite you to mind your own business. The police were not particularly eager in many cases to get tips from the public. The first thing they would ask you is who you are. Carl Ross, according to neighbors, was gay, as were Kitty and Marianne. In that case, the police are not your friend. They don't like you any more than you may like the police. The police would regularly shake down the bars where Kitty and Marianne met, and where they would go and there were underground gay bars in Greenwich Village. This was 5 years before Stonewall. There were, as Marianne told me, you're not marching in a gay pride parade. You are keeping your orientation to yourself, unless you want to be beaten up or arrested. Carl Ross had that reason to hesitate to call the police. There were other neighbors who had fled Europe. This is not that long after World War II, who were also hesitant to call the authorities. And Ross did have that reason for hesitation. The first thing you're going to be asked if you call the police in those days is, who are you? And not what is your emergency. That is one positive, oddly enough, I feel, that has come out of an utter misunderstanding of what happened on that cold night 50 years ago. The need to get a direct line to the police so a car can get going to the place it needs to be. When Ross finally did call the police, a squad car pulled up 2 minutes later, but it was too late to save Kitty's life.
Do you still think the bystander effect is operative even in our age of available resources? And if you would you explain what the bystander effect is?
Yes, it's often misunderstood to mean apathy. And in fact, the bystander effect is another outgrowth of this case. There was a great deal of sociological study. What happened that night and why? The bystander effect is a little counterintuitive. What it says essentially is, if you're being attacked by someone and you need help, you are much more likely to get help if there are only two witnesses or one witness than if there are 10 or 20. And the reason for that is, if there are 20, they tend to look to someone else to act first, someone bigger and stronger than I am, someone more courageous than I am. And what happens is people hesitate and nobody acts. And that has been shown to be true again and again and again. It doesn't particularly apply to what happened to Kitty, because it's not a crowd of people looking around realizing that there are so many other people looking, except in the case of two witnesses, the Koshkins, who looked out a window. They had a particular vantage point and did see Kitty after she turned that corner into the darkness. And Mr. Koshkin is reaching for the phone when his wife says, "The police are just going to ask you a lot of questions. We don't need that. And anyway, 30 people must have called the police by now." Mm. That's the bystander effect in action. And it is true. It's one thing for us to be aware of and try to overcome if you happen to be in a crowd of people, to intervene rather than wait for someone else to do so.
You know, as horrendous as Kitty Genovese's death was, there are some surprising details at the very end of your book, and we don't have to go into them here. But they beg the question of, why were they overlooked for all these years? Why do you think no one bothered to look into all this?
I think it's because the story seemed so well to fit the temper of the times. It seemed to explain what was going on, what was the matter. It seemed also to be a call for action, which is how Abraham Rosenthal of the New York Times saw the story. This is something that will improve the world by telling this story, to get people to act. And I think it's interesting. One of the more interesting aspects of my experience with the book, since the book was published not long ago, was that it's been seen as controversial in some circles to say that Kitty Genovese was not ignored by all of her neighbors, by all of these witnesses, was not abandoned. In fact, later in the book, you'll find that there was one, that she didn't die alone, that there was one who ran to her side
right
at the very end. But the idea that she was not an urban martyr who doesn't teach us all a lesson, and I reject that thought, that that somehow diminishes her, because I don't think that she needs to teach the rest of us a lesson in order to be remembered.
When you say there's been, you know, some controversy about the book, by whom?
There's an academic side that that has taught this story in the way that it's been accepted for 50 years, and it is seen as an effective teaching tool. We must act. That's one reason the Kitty Genovese story is indirectly, at least, responsible for neighborhood watch programs, for Good Samaritan laws in all 50 states, for very positive social issues. And I think there are people who are worried that those things will be diminished. I don't think that they're diminished at all. I think the fact that they arose from a misinterpretation of a case, they still exist and they still save lives. I suspect Kitty Genovese would be pleased by that, but would still want her story told as the truth and not as a myth.
Right. We have a call from Warren in Delray. It came in very late, so Warren, we don't have much time.
It's a quickie, Bonnie. Thank you for allowing me to participate. I came in late, so I didn't hear the side of a small circle of friends was in part based on the terrible Kitty Genovese incident. Another thing, I used to do business on Austin Street, and then right near Austin Street on Kew Gardens Road is Maple Grove Cemetery, which is, as I understand it, the final resting place of Kitty Genovese, also notable because there in an unmarked grave is the master of ragtime, Scott Joplin.
I believe that's true about Joplin. Kitty is buried in Connecticut.
I'm sorry.
Although, yes, people do expect her to be there. But it's absolutely right about the Phil Oakes song. Kitty and Marianne used to go and hear Phil Oakes. And her story was definitely the inspiration for that song,
her
outside
stanza,
a small circle,
yes,
of friends. And it was when we think of Marianne's experience, she heard that song on the radio some years later, and to hear Phil Oakes, who was a favorite of theirs, sing about Kitty.
Look outside the window. There's a woman being grabbed. They've dragged her to the bushes, and now she's being stabbed.
Right.
Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain, but Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to spoil the game.
That's it. Okay, Warren.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. Great luck with your book.
Thanks.
Did you get to interview anyone in Kitty's family for the book?
I spoke to her brother, Bill, only briefly. He is working on a documentary. Bill Genovese is another person who was so struck by the way that the story of his sister was told. He went to Vietnam. He was 19 years old, and apparently to protect some other soldiers, he fell on a grenade and lost both of his legs. He's been in a wheelchair ever since. He's working on a film about his experience, not the same sort of detection that I have attempted, but about how his life was changed by this momentous and misunderstood event of 50 years ago.
There's also, I'm sure you did read the article in The New Yorker about your book, and there was,
yes,
another one as well that they mentioned, which I guess takes issue with, or that stays with the basic narrative that's always been told.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think that's the point of that book, and it's hard for me to understand how that point can be made in light of what we know today.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Kevin Cook. He's an award-winning author and journalist, written several books, and his latest book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystander, The Crime That Changed America. And you said it's Kitty Genovese, the book, at .tumblr.com?
That's right.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate your being here with us today, and we thank you. We thank you so much, and I enjoyed, not that I enjoyed, what do I want to say? It's an excellent book.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Okay, thanks for being with us. And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads from our website, WLRN.org. And more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's program looks at why and how religions have had such an immense impact on human history, and uncovers the ineradicable connection between politics and religion.